You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Father, may the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. When Jesus passes by. There are seasons in life when we find ourselves sitting at the edge of things. Perhaps you know that kind of place, a place where you feel left behind, a place where you're no longer sure you belong, a place where your failures seem larger than your hopes, a place where shame settles over you like a heavy fog. Most of us have been there at some time or another. Maybe you're there this morning. One of those low points in my life came in November 2009. Earlier that year, I had completed my PhD and successfully defended my dissertation. That was supposed to be the beginning of a scholarly vocation, a scholarly calling. The next step was supposed to be obvious: publish your thesis and move forward into your vocation. But for reasons I won't rehearse this morning, I decided not to publish it. And then a few months later, I attended something called the annual meeting of the Society of Biblical Literature. It's a gathering of thousands of biblical scholars over the course of a weekend. And throughout that weekend, I kept bumping into friends and acquaintances who asked me obvious questions like, "Have you finished your dissertation?" To which I replied, "Yes." And then they said, "So, are you going to publish it?" "No." And then there would be a long pause. Essentially, I was telling them, my scholarly career is now dead in the water. And that happened over and over again. And finally, after about 3 days of this Q&A, I was just emotionally exhausted. I felt like a fraud among the real scholars. I felt as though I had stepped outside the circle of respectability. I carried shame, disappointment, and not a significant amount of regret. And then on Sunday morning of the conference, I attended a worship service in one of those enormous conference rooms. Maybe you've been in those. When the service ended, everybody left. They went to present papers, to listen to papers, to be active as scholars, and I remained seated. Soon I realized I was completely alone in this vast room. I sat there. I just felt numb. I was ashamed, I was lost, and I went and found a secluded table and sat there alone. It felt like I was looking in on others from the outside across an unseen boundary. The biblical text from Matthew 9 doesn't tell us much, but I wonder if Matthew knew some of those feelings. When Jesus first sees him, Matthew is sitting at a tax table. He's a Jew collecting taxes for Rome. His profession has made him wealthy, perhaps, but it has also made him suspect. He has become one of those people everyone talks about, but nobody wants to be associated with. The respectable people have already decided who Matthew is. His story has been written, his place assigned, his future settled. Then Jesus walks by, not with condemnation, not with suspicion, not with a lecture, just two words: "Follow me." And Matthew gets up. That's how grace arrives. Not as reward, not as recognition for spiritual achievement, not because we've finally become worthy. Grace comes because Jesus comes. Some scholars I know remind us that the grace of God is startlingly this way precisely because of its incongruity, because of its absurdity on some levels. God doesn't wait for people to become valuable before valuing them. God doesn't wait for people to become worthy before giving himself to them. Jesus doesn't call Matthew because Matthew is admirable. Jesus calls Matthew because Jesus is gracious. The story hardly has time to settle before there's an interruption. Did you notice it? Behold, a synagogue leader. We find out in the Gospels of Mark and Luke that his name is Jairus, comes and kneels at Jesus' feet. The word almost evokes he's worshiping at Jesus' feet. He's fallen at his feet. His young daughter has died. Death has entered his home. His world has collapsed. He doesn't come with theological arguments as his fellow Pharisees did. He comes with desperation. Come and lay your hand on my daughter, and she will live. And Jesus goes. Then on the way, there's another interruption, another behold moment. Behold, a woman emerges from the crowd. For 12 years, her lifeblood, and that is not a metaphor, has been ebbing away. For 12 years, she has carried weakness, disappointment, and isolation. According to the purity laws of Israel, her condition rendered her perpetually unclean. This was not a moral failure. At least it doesn't say that. It doesn't say she was guilty of any sin, but her condition nevertheless placed barriers between herself and the ordinary rhythms of her Jewish community at work and worship. 12 years of careful distance. 12 years of being avoided. 12 years of living at the margins. Yet seeing an opportunity, she reaches out. One touch, just the fringe of his garment, that is all. And immediately, Jesus turns and sees her. The crowd sees an anonymous woman. Jesus sees a daughter. The crowd sees impurity. Jesus sees faith. The crowd sees someone to avoid. Jesus sees someone to embrace. Take heart, daughter. Your faith has made you well. The word made well could just as easily be translated saved. She's not merely healed, but she's saved. A salvation both for today and it's ongoing into the future. You are made whole, he tells her. You are restored. You're brought home. What unites all of these stories in this passage in Matthew 9 is that Jesus keeps crossing boundaries to encounter people. A tax collector, a bleeding woman, a dead girl. Three people, and each on the wrong side of a line, beyond a boundary of one sort or another. And Jesus keeps stepping across those boundary lines to come to them. He enters the world of sinners. He allows the unclean to touch him. He takes a dead girl by the hand. Everywhere he goes, Jesus moves toward places where others in his day would usually try to avoid. But notice what happens. Impurity does not spread to Jesus. Rather, his holiness spreads to them. Jesus sits at table with tax collectors and sinners. Their sin doesn't contaminate him. His righteousness begins transforming them. The woman reaches out with a hand that should have made Jesus unclean. Instead, his life flows into her. Jesus enters a house overshadowed by death, but death does not conquer him. His life overwhelms death. I mean, that's the gospel in miniature. What Jesus is doing here in Galilee, he will finally do on Golgotha. He crosses the vast boundary between God and humanity. He enters our brokenness. He enters our shame. He enters our suffering. He enters our death. Resurrection Sunday is the full-blown picture, of course. On Easter morning, Jesus brings life out of death, purity out of impurity, communion out of estrangement. He takes hold of us and refuses to let us go. When Jesus enters the ruler's house, mourners are already gathered there. The noise of death fills the house. The professional mourners laugh at him when he says the girl is just sleeping. But Jesus is unmoved. He puts them outside and he enters the room. And then Matthew uses a wonderfully descriptive word. It says, Jesus took her hand. He took her by the hand. The Greek verb is kratio. And I just tell you that because I drive by a business called Kratos. It's the noun form of that Greek verb. I drive by this business, and maybe some of you know it too. I drive by it just about every day, Kratos. I don't really know exactly what they do. It's probably secretive. But the word means power. It means strength. And every time I drive by it, I think of Jesus' strength with me, his strong grip on me. But the verb itself that's used here in Matthew 9, is, kratio means to seize, to grasp firmly, to hold with strength. My point is that Jesus' touch isn't a tentative touch. This is a strong hand, the strong hand of God. It's the same mighty hand and outstretched arm that delivered Israel from Egypt and now reaches into a room gripped by death, and the girl arises. That is what Jesus does. He takes hold of people. He takes hold of Matthew at the tax booth. He takes hold of a woman whose hope has nearly bled away. He takes hold of a dead girl. And sometimes he takes hold of discouraged biblical scholars sitting alone in a conference room. For on that Sunday morning in 2009, I prayed a simple prayer thinking my vocation was dead. And I said, Lord, help me. Help me. Absolutely nothing dramatic happened in that moment. There was no vision, there was no voice, no lightning bolt. But by the end of that day, a series of unexpected conversations began like has never happened before or since in my life as a biblical scholar. A friend of mine came looking for me and found me, and she grabbed me and she said, follow me. She introduced me to somebody, and a commentary project on the book of Acts was offered to me. A few hours later, I was then asked, after I bumped into another person randomly in the book stalls, if I would contribute to a chapter on a book on the Gospel of Luke. I was like, sure. Then a few hours later, I was asked by someone else if I'd be interested in contributing 5 articles to a new dictionary on Paul and his letters. And then finally, late in the afternoon, I received, as if just to put the cherry on top of the day, somebody asked me, would you like to write a chapter on Josephus? I'd done some work on Josephus in my dissertation. Would you like to write a chapter on Josephus on a book that we're doing? And I just shook my head. Because at that moment I said, you know, I've just got too much on my plate right now. By the end of the day, my circumstances had changed. But more importantly, I was changed. I discovered again that I had been seen, not by a conference, not by an academic guild, but by Christ. The deeper gift was not scholarly opportunity. The deeper gift was the realization that Jesus had found me before I knew how lost I was. That is how the gospel often works. But the gospel works in so many more creative ways than just that. Some of us are like Matthew. Jesus finds us while we're still sitting in places where we shouldn't be. Some of us are like the woman. We can barely reach out, but somehow manage to touch just the hem of his garment. Some of us are like Jairus. We come carrying grief that is just too heavy to bear. And some of us are like the dead girl. We have nothing left to offer at all. Yet in every case, the story begins not with human initiative, but with divine initiative. Jesus is already on the move, already seeking, already coming near, already crossing boundaries, already passing by. And when Jesus passes by, he doesn't merely improve our circumstances. He gives life where there is death. He gives hope where hope has ebbed away. He gives belonging where there is estrangement. He gives wholeness where there is fragmentation. Jesus gives himself. He looks at estranged Matthew and he says, follow me. He turns to a desperate woman and says, daughter. He takes a dead girl strongly by the hand and she rises up. And he speaks the same gospel words to us. Follow me. Take heart. Rise up. Amen.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.